headlines this hour. France reports 208,000 new COVID-19 cases, Europe's biggest surge in daily infections amid the spread of the Omicron variant. Health officials in the Gaza Strip say several Palestinian farmers have been wounded in an Israeli artillery attack in the besieged territory. And local activists and political parties in Indian-controlled Kashmir accuse New Delhi of trying to change the demography of the disputed region. Thanks for joining us. France registers 208,000 new cases of COVID-19, breaking the previous record of the country's daily infections since the outbreak of the disease. France has been breaking COVID-19 records repeatedly over the past few days. The health minister says the situation in the hospitals was worrying because of the Delta variant, with the Omicron strain yet to have an impact. The surge comes as the World Health Organization has warned that the circulation of the Delta and Omicron variants is creating a, quote, tsunami of cases. The WHO has also warned that Omicron poses a very high risk and could yet overwhelm healthcare systems. Meanwhile, an AFP data shows the world has hit a record number of COVID infections in a week. Our correspondent in Paris, Chris Delhomme, tells us more about the French government's measures to fight COVID-19 amid a massive surge in cases and the spread of the Omicron variant.
Well, everybody is amazed about the incredible number of new contaminations every 24 hours. It's not just a French record, it's a European record, over 200,000 the last 24 hours. So the situation in hospitals is worrying, and the French government very recently has taken some new measures in order to contain this new tsunami, what some call a tsunami in the contaminations. But these measures are rather soft. There is no new lockdown, no new curfew, and the schools will open after the New Year's Eve. So there will be a delay. The delay for new vaccination will be limited to 3 months instead of the actual 4 months for new vaccinations. The work at home is stimulated. Gatherings, interior gatherings, are limited to 2,000, and exterior gatherings are limited to 5,000. The most important measure, however, is the transformation of the mandatory health pass in a vaccination pass. Everybody has to show that he or she is vaccinated in order to go to public places. Now, why are these measures rather soft? The reason is that the French government considers the vaccination campaign as rather efficient. So there are a huge number of new contaminations, but few people show severe symptoms or arrive in hospitals.
Israel has attacked several security posts of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas with artillery fire in the Gaza Strip. The shelling leaves at least 3 Palestinian farmers injured. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon tells us more.
Israeli tanks used tank shells and machine guns to attack Hamas security posts in the east of the Gaza Strip and areas like Beit Hanun, Jabalia, area east of Gaza City, and also east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. And minutes ago, we learned that at least 3 farmers sustained light injuries during these recent Israeli attacks. The Israeli regime claims that these attacks were retaliation for alleged sniper fire from Gaza that hit an Israeli in the east of the enclave earlier, although no one in Gaza has claimed responsibility for attacking any Israeli soldiers in the east of the enclave. These recent attacks come while Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza are holding military maneuvers to exercise their military capabilities and also to stress their preparedness and readiness to face any future Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip.
Another Palestinian family has just become homeless. An Israeli bulldozer has destroyed a home in a town near the occupied Al-Quds. We're learning the protests broke out in Jabal al-Mukabar during the demolition. Israeli forces used rubber bullets and tear gas to push back the Palestinian protesters, injuring several of them. Israel regularly raises Palestinian structures, saying that they lack construction permits, but Palestinians say that those permits are impossible to obtain. The UN has reported a 21% increase in the number of Palestinian structures that were confiscated or destroyed this year. Palestinians say that the demolitions are part of Israel's efforts to make room for illegal settlements. Political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says the demolition of Palestinian homes is in line with the Israeli regime's goal to Judaize the entire occupied territories.
Well, first of all, this is completely in line with Zionism's settler colonial movement concept, you know, transforming an Arab country, Palestine, into a Judaized Zionist entity. So this is just part and parcel of a whole range of things which Israel gets up to. But it's particularly obnoxious that this actual demolition of houses is really, I mean, it's been criticized by human rights organizations as a form of collective punishment, and therefore it's technically a war crime under international law. That's the first thing that has to be, you know, alarming to anybody neutral looking at this situation. And then, of course, the facts on the ground. 52,000 homes were totally demolished in the wake of the Nakba in 1948, and since then, of course, you know, there's been a never-ending destruction of these homes. 530 entire villages, towns, and centers, urban centers, were destroyed as well since that period. And the systematic demolition of Palestinian homes, mosques, and other buildings is just almost like normalized now. The fact of the matter is that just this year alone, it's claimed that over 15,000 plus homes have been targeted. I think 30%, there's a statistic I got, which was 30% of East Jerusalem's Palestinian homes are listed for destruction.
The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas comes under criticism from the resistance movement Hamas over his recent meeting with Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz. Hamas spokesman says that Abbas' meeting with Gantz has deepened political divisions among Palestinians. Hazem Qassam says the behavior of the Palestinian Authority complicates the situation and encourages the normalization of ties with the regime. He was referring to several Arab countries, including the United Arab Emirates, that signed U.S. brokered normalization deals with Israel. Gantz hosted Abbas at his home in Rosh Ha'ayin on Tuesday night. It was the second meeting between the two. They first met in Ramallah back in August. The Yemeni army says it has liberated more areas from Saudi and UAE-backed militias in Al-Jawf province. During a press conference, army spokesman Yahya Sari gave the details and released footage of the ongoing operation in Al-Jawf.
We have taken control of complete Jawf desert, and it has been liberated. They are the heroes of the Yemeni army and the popular forces. They have come to clear out the area of the mercenaries and the aggressive alliance troops. They have liberated the area of Yatama and went towards the desert. They are all fleeing, those mercenaries. We have liberated that area. They are fleeing their posts. This is the Saudi aggression that is being defeated in Sana'a, in Jawf, in Saba, in Hodeidah. The airstrikes against Yemen were more than 500 bombshells against those areas. And we launched an operation in order to respond and retaliate to the crimes of the mercenaries. They will not succeed in hitting the determination and the will of the Yemeni people. This alliance, aggressive alliance, has launched this aggression and continues and will not succeed in breaking the will of the people, of the Yemeni people.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, local activists and political parties are protesting a recent government-organized summit that encouraged Indians to buy real estate in the region. They say the government is putting up the region for sale. Critics are accusing the government of trying to change the demography of Kashmir. They say the government needs to focus on job creation instead because the region is facing a huge unemployment crisis. But the government argues that such conferences are only meant to encourage external investment and to develop the region. Up until 2 years ago, people who were are not permanent residents of Kashmir were barred from purchasing property. In 2019, the government canceled Kashmir's partial autonomy and brought it under direct rule. Anger has been simmering in the region ever since, with pro-independence fighters frequently clashing with government forces. Iman says the recent Israeli air raid against Syria's port city of Latakia clearly shows that Tel Aviv is provoking crises in the West Asia region. The foreign ministry spokesman says that the attack amounts to violating the sovereignty of Syria, which is a UN member. Saeed Khatibzadeh described the strike as immoral and inhumane. He said that Israel is making a mockery of international law by conducting repeated attacks on the Syrian soil under false pretext. Khatibzadeh said the silence of the international community gives Israel the green light to continue such acts of aggression. Syrian media say Tuesday's attack targeted containers carrying engine oil and spare parts for cars and other vehicles. The Israeli raid also damaged residential buildings, hospitals, and shops in the Syrian port city. Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks, Ali Bagharikani, meets with the EU envoy to the negotiations, Enrico Mora. Meeting as part of the new round of the negotiations that are ongoing, the focus on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. We're now crossing to Vienna, where our correspondent Homa Leslie is standing by to hear from her what's new about the talks. So Homa, what is new about the talks?
Yes, Carver, so we just had a meeting between the Iranian lead negotiator, Deputy Foreign Minister Mr. Ali Bagharikani, and representatives of the three European signatories to the JCPOA, Britain, France, and Germany. Earlier, as you said, Mr. Bagheri also had a meeting with the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora. There's been a lot of back and forth today. We saw the Russian ambassador, Mr. Mikhail Oryanov, also going inside the Palais Faubourg, and he also tweeted after that that he'd also met with the American team led by Rob Malley, and that close consultations and close coordination, in his words, with the American team is a prerequisite for progress to be made in these talks. Of course, we know that there are two processes here in the Vienna talks. One is between Iran and the P4 plus one, the remaining signatories, and then there's also the indirect involvement of the US team. When we're talking about the most important aspect of these talks, it is the removal of US sanctions. So the ideas, proposals, and the positions of the Iranian team are conveyed to the Europeans, to the EU coordinator, to Russia and China, and then to the Americans via these delegations. And then, of course, the response or the positions of the Americans conveyed back to Iran, again, via the EU coordinator and the other European and other delegations. So we had a lot of back and forth like that today. It looks like that the talks are continuing at what we could assume is a normal pace. There hasn't been any statements to the media officially or unofficially today, which is usually a sign that there's a lot of activity taking place behind the scenes. We know that the decision has been for the sides to have a little 3-day break because of the New Year's, probably on Friday, and then to pick up the talks from where they were left off on Monday. As of now, Iran is saying that it will is sticking to its position of wanting verification and guarantees from the Americans. When it comes to sanctions removal, it says these are the proposals that it's put forward, and Iran's team says it sees this as a good sign that the other side, the other parties, have acknowledged that this is and should be part of the negotiations. Because initially, we're talking earlier, you told me about this criticism against the French delegation. It looks like, for instance, initially that delegation and the other Europeans were not even willing to consider these issues to be on the agenda. Then there was some progress made. These were issues that were included. You know, when we're talking about why Iran is insisting on this verification and guarantee issue, we know that when the JCPOA was signed in 2015, what happened was that the Trump administration withdrew in 2018 without giving Iran the economic benefit, and on top of that, imposed the maximum pressure policy on the country, and secondly, sanctions that also stopped any other European or international countries, firms or companies from working with Iran. So in spite of all that, Iran stayed committed to its obligations for another whole year, and then it started gradually withdrawing from the JCPOA itself. And now Mr. Barghari is saying because it was the US that violated the deal, there is, of course, this leads to a lack of trust between the two sides. What's important for Iran, if it, that trust is going to be built, is to get this effective guarantee and verification covered.
Thank you so much, Homa. We appreciate it. Homa Leski there from Vienna. Many thanks. Okay, moving on. China says that it will have to take drastic measures if Taiwan keeps pushing for independence. The spokesman for Taiwan Affairs Office says that Beijing is seeking peaceful reunification with Taipei. But he warned that China will have to take extreme measures if Taiwan crosses the red lines. According to the official, the situation in the Taiwan Strait could become more complex in the coming months due to foreign intervention and provocation by separatist forces. The United States has been angering China with diplomatic contacts with and arms sales to Taiwan. China considers the island as its territory. Parents of a Chilean immigrant teenager shot dead by U.S. police are calling for justice. Valentina Orellana Peralta was killed last Thursday during a chaotic police operation in a department store in California. She was hiding in a changing room when a police officer responding to an attack fired a bullet that struck her chest. Valentina's father says the officers involved in her killing are criminals and must be jailed. Los Angeles police say the officer is now on paid administrative leave and that a complete transparent investigation will be conducted. U.S. police are known to be readily use force to confront criminal suspects. Last year alone, they have shot and killed more than 900 people. And that does it for World News to stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Even if highly contagious COVID-19 variant maximizes its potential, laws of biochemistry show the virus cannot keep improving indefinitely. We're prepared for an article written by Ben Krishna, a postdoctoral researcher, immunology and virology, University of Cambridge. The piece is titled, Why Omicron May Be the Final Variant of Concern. The article has been published by the Asia Times. It is controversial whether viruses are alive, but like all living things, they do evolve. This fact has become abundantly clear during the pandemic, as new variants of concern have emerged every few months. Some of these variants have been better at spreading from person to person, eventually becoming dominant as they outcompete slower versions of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. This improved spreading ability has been ascribed to mutations in the spike protein. The mushroom-shaped projections on the surface of the virus that allow it to bind more strongly to ACE2 receptors in the human body. ACE2 are receptors on the surface of our cells, such as those that line our airways, that the virus attaches to in order to gain entry and start replicating. These mutations allowed the Alpha variant and then the Delta variant to become globally dominant. And scientists expect the same thing to happen with the Omicron variant. However, the virus cannot improve indefinitely. The laws of biochemistry mean that the virus will eventually evolve a spike protein that binds to ACE2 as strongly as possible. By that point, the ability of SARS-CoV-2 to spread between people will not be limited by how well the virus can stick to the outside of cells. Other factors will limit viral spread, such as how fast the genome can replicate, how quickly the virus can enter the cell via the protein TMPRSS2, and how much virus an infected human can shed. In principle, all of these should eventually evolve to peak performance. Has the Omicron variant reached this peak? There is no good reason to assume that it has. So-called gain-of-function studies, which look at what mutations SARS-CoV-2 needs to spread more efficiently, have identified plenty of mutations that improve the spike protein's ability to bind to human cells that Omicron doesn't have. Besides this, improvements could be made to other aspects of the virus's life cycle, such as genome replication, as we mentioned above. But let's assume, for a second, that Omicron variant is the variant with maximized spreading ability. Perhaps Omicron won't get any better because it is limited by genetic probability. In the same way that zebras haven't evolved eyes at the back of their heads to avoid predators, it's plausible that SARS-CoV-2 can't pick up the mutations required to reach a theoretical maximum, as those mutations need to occur all at once, and that is just too unlikely to emerge. Even in a scenario where Omicron variant is the best variant at spreading between humans, new variants will emerge to handle the human immune system. After infection with any virus, the immune system adapts by making antibodies that stick to the virus to neutralize it and killer T cells that destroy infected cells. Antibodies are pieces of protein that stick to the specific molecular shape of the virus, and killer T cells recognize infected cells via molecular shape as well. SARS-CoV-2 can therefore evade the immune system by mutating sufficiently that its molecular shape changes beyond the immune system's recognition. That is why Omicron is so apparently successful at infecting people with previous immunity, either from vaccines or infections with other variants of the virus, the mutations that allow the spike to bind to ACE2 cells more strongly also reduce the ability of antibodies to bind to the virus and neutralize it. Pfizer's data suggests that T cells should respond similarly to the Omicron variant as to previous variants, which aligns with the observation that Omicron has a lower fatality rate in South Africa, where most people have immunity. Importantly for humanity, past exposure still seems to protect against severe disease and death, leaving us with a compromise where the virus can replicate and reinfect, but we do not get as severely sick as the first time. Herein lies the most probable future for this virus. Even if it behaves like a professional gamer and eventually maxes out all its stats, there is no reason to think that it won't be controlled and cleared by the immune system in our bodies. The mutations that improve its spreading ability do not greatly increase deaths. This maxed out virus would then simply mutate randomly, changing enough over time to become unrecognizable to the immune system's adapted defenses, allowing waves of reinfection. We might have COVID season each winter in the same way we have flu season now. Influenza viruses can also have a similar pattern of mutation over time, known as antigenic drift, leading to reinfections. Each year's new flu viruses are not necessarily better than last year's, just sufficiently different. Perhaps the best evidence for this eventuality for SARS-CoV-2 is that 229E, a coronavirus that causes the common cold, does this already. Omicron variant will therefore not be the final variant, but it may be the final variant of concern. If we are lucky, and the course of this pandemic is hard to predict, SARS-CoV-2 will probably become an endemic virus that slowly mutates over time. The disease might very likely be mild, as some past exposure creates immunity that reduces the likelihood of hospitalization and death. Most people will get infected the first time as a child, which could occur before or after a vaccine, and subsequent reinfections will barely be noticed. Only a small group of scientists will track SARS-CoV-2's genetic changes over time, and the variants of concern will become a thing of the past, at least until the next virus jumps the species barrier.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
On this occasion of Fatimiya, I would like to discuss how the Lady Fatimatu Zahra, Salamullahi alayha, has saved the Ummah. There are many ways that we can look at this, and her standing behind the door saved the Ummah in many ways. One of those is obviously, and we've discussed this before, last year, maybe the previous year, in the context of Fatimiyyah, of how it was important for her to keep Ali ibn Abi Talib alive as the Imam, not just alive. Keep him alive and give him the opportunity, the ability to be the Imam and live. We explained that in a previous Fatimiyyah. So her Shahada made that possible. We explained that there as well. How this Shahada allowed for Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullah alayhi to live as an Imam and continue doing his work as an Imam afterwards. If it wasn't for that shahada of the Lady Fatimatu Zahra, that wouldn't have been possible. That by itself is an aspect, is something to think about and to appreciate and to thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the great blessing of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra. But what we're discussing is not related to that. It's related to the istishhad itself and her effect directly, as the Quran says generally shuhada have. Although she was a living shaheed while she was alive, she was عند ربهم يرزقون. Her soul was عند ربهم يرزقون in ways that we can't really comprehend. Her istishhad, according to the Quran, has the highest level of what the Quran says a shaheed's effect and impact on the people after, the believers after that shahada are. This is the part that we're discussing here. Her shahada saved Islam, saved the ummah. Islam as a religion was going to be preserved as long as there's one person on the face of the earth that knows what God revealed upon the Holy Prophet, what his guidance and his teachings are, then Islam as an ideology is preserved on the face of the earth. The ummah growing, continuing to live, and reaching its destination, which has been happening over the course of these centuries and will reach its final stage with the coming of the Imam of our time and with the work that he does, all of this is affected by Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayhi, her shahada, her istijhad, her martyrdom. So not because she saved and preserved Ali ibn Abi Talib, that itself is an aspect, we discussed that, that is important, that's not our topic right now. Her shahada, her istijhad, her martyrdom. What is the effect? One effect, again, of that shahada that we can understand has saved the ummah, and a lot of people have spoken about this, is the idea that that shahada was recorded in history. And it leaves a question. All the efforts, all the attempts to try to hide the truth of what happened after the demise of the Prophet, to try to hide the truth that Ali ibn Abi Talib is the Khalifa. With her shahada, which has been recorded in history, and there is no other version of her passing, no other record of her passing is there. The record of her passing is her passing because of her injuries at that young age. So either you say, well, we don't know, she just passed, or you say, let's look at what's recorded. The only thing that's recorded is this. Nothing else has been recorded. Well, this is an effect that is because of her shahada, not because of saving Ali ibn Abi Talib. With her shahada, she saved this truth, and the ummah needs this truth. Yes, that's true. Another aspect that is spoken of and is important and definitely has saved us and continues to save us the more we do this is remembering her and crying for her injuries, crying for her arm, crying for what happened to her behind the door, crying for her chest being pierced with a hot nail. These scenes that we should remember, the way Ali ibn Abi Talib stood in washing that body, and the way he cried, and the way the children cried, and remembering that, and our hearts really not being able to take that, and our tears flowing down our faces, that, and now that this happened, and they cried for Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, they're able to come back to the path, be able to remain Muslim and so, or Shia, or, no. Saving everyone, the greatest alim that you could imagine, the greatest arif that you could imagine, those tears for Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, save them from that level of deficiency that they're in and elevates them. All of us are anyone who is connected to her in that way. Anyone who not even cries, who reads that story, their heart is moved even a bit. And that bit, that amount that it's moved, and they are saved to that degree. This is a concept, an aspect of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, that encompasses all these different people throughout this time, all these different people. That is an aspect as well. However, that is still not, neither of those two are ones that we are wanting to discuss. Her shahada is a savior for the ummah, because that shahada, that martyrdom, tells those who hear of that, tells them that this shahada is good, want it. Desire it, long for it, tell God to give it to you, tell Allah, I wish I was there, that my chest would have been pierced instead of hers, tell God, I wish I was in that street, my face would have been slapped in that way instead of hers. Of Fatima al-Zahra, creating the desire for reaching that same level. The verse of the Quran is very interesting. It says, "Al-ladina lam yalhaqu bihim." It says, "Shuhada," generally, and at the top is the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha. She addresses, and all these shuhada address, الَّذِينَ لَمْ يَلْحَقُوا بِهِمْ, the ones who have not joined them. This wording has an implication with it. In other words, people that have not yet come that way, which means that they would be reaching that level. The highest level that a person can reach is to become a shaheed. They are told, don't worry, there's no fear, keep going. Keep going for what? To reach that, reach shahada, reach martyrdom. Anyone who reads the story, hears the story of Fatima al-Zahra, while they beat themselves when they hear that, and they can't take hearing what happened to her, it's too much, they want that what happened to her would happen to them instead. They would want not to leave this world in anything less than that. That's what it calls you towards. It calls a person towards doing what she did for the sake of Islam, for saving Walaya, for saving Ali ibn Abi Talib. What God requires you to do is to give your life. Look at that, you read this while you're crying, while you're hearing this, while your heart is being moved. A believer cannot help but to want to do the same. God, bring about a condition where I too, like Zahra salamullahi alayha, can give my blood for your cause.
أسعفيني بفيضك المعطاء
إنه سلمي إلى العلياء فامنحي نفحة الحياة يا سبيلي إلى النجاة يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء يا طريقا إلى العلا
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا
وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء.
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي، يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء، يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء،
فاطم الزهراء.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
One analyst warned the West Virginia Democrats' obstruction of his party's legislative agenda puts the economic recovery at risk. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Manchin under fire for blown potential $60 billion hole in U.S. economy during pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Beyond its near, immediate, and potentially devastating impact on millions of families with children, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's obstruction of his party's Build Back Better package could have far-reaching consequences for the overall U.S. economy as the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage at home and abroad. According to a Business Insider calculation derived from Goldman Sachs' new adjusted growth projections, the death of Democrats' $1.75 trillion reconciliation measure could deprive the U.S. economy of $60 billion in gross domestic product, GDP, over the next three quarters, hampering the nation's fragile recovery. The outlet noted economists are already forecasting what a BBB-free economy would look like, and early projections are gloomy. Goldman Sachs economists, led by Jan Hatzius, now expect U.S. GDP to grow 2% in the first quarter, 3% in the second quarter, and 2.75% in the third quarter, according to estimates published recently. Those projections are down from 3%, 3.5%, and 3%, respectively. The financial services firm's Moody's Analytics, for its part, projected earlier this year that passage of both the reconciliation bill and the bipartisan infrastructure package, which President Joe Biden signed into law last month, would boost real GDP growth to 4.8% next year. Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's, warned in a series of tweets recently that if BBB doesn't become law, real GDP growth in 2022 will be lower by 0.5%, and reaching full employment next year will prove elusive. Fallout will be quick as families with children will lose a tax break, he continued.
Without BBB, the economic recovery will be vulnerable to stalling out if we suffer another serious wave of the pandemic. An increasingly likely scenario with Omicron spreading rapidly. Detractors of BBB worry about inflation, but without it, the worry is more likely to be growth. Democrats' flagship social spending and climate legislation proposed investing billions of dollars in safety net programs, including an expanded child tax credit, Medicaid, and pre-K, and renewable energy initiatives over the next decade, in an effort to cut poverty, bolster healthcare coverage, and combat the planetary emergency. According to an analysis conducted by the Economic Policy Institute in October, the slate of policy proposals in the Build Back Better Act combined with the bipartisan infrastructure package would have supported 4 million jobs annually. But over several months of negotiations, Manchin and other right-wing Democrats slowly chipped away at the legislation, removing key climate and healthcare provisions and ultimately cutting the bill's proposed spending level in half. Manchin dealt what many saw as the death blow, telling Fox News that he would vote no on the Build Back Better Act should it reach the floor in its current form, likely spelling the end of programs like the expanded child tax credit, which reduced poverty and bolstered consumer spending by putting money directly in families' pockets. Behind the scenes, Manchin reportedly told colleagues that he thought parents would waste monthly child tax credit CDC programs on drugs, and instead of providing for children, ignoring research showing that families have largely spent the money on groceries and other necessities. In a statement released to the public recently, the West Virginia Democrat offered several other objections to the bill that economists and other analysts slammed as nonsensical. He says he's worried about inflation and the national debt, but Build Back Better will be paid for with tax increases on big corporations and the wealthy, so it won't have any bearing on inflation or debt. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich wrote in a blog post following Manchin's statement. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says he's worried about the impact of the latest COVID surge on the economy. But if COVID slows the economy, there is even more justification for federal spending that strengthens social safety nets. He says he can't face his constituents in West Virginia without renouncing Build Back Better. But on a per-person basis, West Virginians would be among the biggest beneficiaries of the legislation in all of America. One out of four West Virginians over 65 have no natural teeth, for example, the highest rate in the nation. Biden's original bill provided dental benefits under Medicare. Despite Manchin's opposition, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wrote in a letter to his caucus recently that he intends to bring the Build Back Better Act to the floor for a vote early in the new year, so that every member of this body has the opportunity to make their position known on the Senate floor, not just on television. We are going to vote on a revised version of the House-passed Build Back Better Act, and we will keep voting until we get something done, Schumer added, without offering specific details on what the adjusted bill would look like. In a statement, Groundwork Collaborative Executive Director Lindsay Owens argued that if Senator Manchin is concerned about inflation, then he should join us in fighting back against the corporate profiteering that is driving it, rather than trying to derail legislation that will not impact inflation one bit. The economic case for Build Back Better is crystal clear. Putting more money into people's pockets helps families participate fully in our economy. Investing in childcare and paid leave helps workers stay healthy and return to work. And tackling the climate crisis is essential to building a more resilient and sustainable future, Allen said. Pressing and passing the Build Back Better Act isn't just about ensuring that Senator Manchin honors his commitment. It's about building an economy that works for all families, not just the wealthy and well-connected, she continued. Especially given the new COVID variant and rising economic uncertainty, it's more important than ever for Congress to stand up to the corporate interest who benefit from this broken status quo and put us on the path to economic resilience by passing the Build Back Better Act in full without further delay.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If the truth is not clarified today, the place of the oppressors and the oppressed will be changed. December 12, 2021. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure household. particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate each and every one of you, dear brothers and sisters, and the honorable, respected activists who work in the health profession on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Hazrat Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, and Nurses Day. This meeting is a good opportunity to speak about the defenders of health and the dear nurses. But before that, I deem it necessary to raise few points in honor of the great lady of Karbala, Hazrat Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Many discussions have been held and many complimentary remarks have been made about Zainab al-Kubra, which all have been correct. But there are two important points that may be seen in the life of the great person that I wish to discuss here. The first and foremost point is that Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, showed the great spiritual and intellectual capacity of women to all of history and to the entire world. This is very important. Despite the foolish wishes of the people to humiliate women at the time, and those who are doing so in our time, Zainab al-Kubra was able to show the highest status of women and the great psychological, mental, and spiritual strength of women. I will give a brief commentary about these points. When I said that they are humiliating women today, this is a fact, but I do not want to enter into that discussion now. More than anyone else, it is the West who is humiliating women in a dangerous way. The great person, Zainab alayhi salam, showed two points. The first point is that women can be a vast ocean of patience and endurance. And the second point is that women can be a peak of wisdom and prudence.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.